From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peake.
And I'm John Wells.
Well, the company Theranos was at one point a $10 billion company founded by Stanford dropout Elizabeth Holmes, who founded the company claiming to have revolutionary new healthcare technology. It was a blood testing device that could allegedly quickly test just a few drops of blood. Well, Elizabeth Holmes' fraud trial began yesterday. It all raises this question surrounding healthcare technology startups. There's, of course, a lot of promise out there, but also how do we trust and evaluate what we see out there as consumers or perhaps investors? Joining us now is Dan Riskin. He returns to Cool Science Radio to talk us through this question as a founder and very involved in many healthcare startups. Dan Riskin is the founder and CEO of Verontos. It's a company dedicated to using AI, artificial intelligence, and real-world evidence to drive change and equality in healthcare. Dan Riskin, welcome back to Cool Science Radio.
Hi, Lynn. Hi, John. It's a pleasure to be back.
Well, it's great to have you back. We're excited for you to come and talk to us about this trial, which is so interesting. Can we start first with, because you understand this, I'm certain more than we do, what Theranos claimed to do that was so revolutionary with this blood testing device?
Sure. Anyone who's ever gone to the doctor and had a blood test has had that experience of someone drawing their blood, where they poke a big needle into your vein, they sit there for some time and fill up vials of blood. It's an unpleasant experience, and then you have to wait a long time for results. All of us in healthcare would rather have a better experience, would rather have perhaps a finger prick like some people do daily with diabetes.
Right.
Something that is maybe not pleasant, but a lot easier than a big needle and time to fill up vials. All of us would rather have that and instant results. And I think doctors and the entire healthcare industry would love to see that. It would really benefit patients. That's what Theranos was claiming. They were claiming that they were on the road to figure that out, that they were starting out with just being able to use a drop of blood to do many tests, and that over time it was going to get faster and faster.
And really, well, maybe you could tell us your own personal story with walking into a Walgreens or something like that in Palo Alto and seeing this Theranos device. So it came onto the market, actually. But what was your experience?
Well, I was quite curious. I having been in Silicon Valley for a long time, I knew a lot of the same people who knew Elizabeth. I asked what their experience was with her. They said she was compelling. I had heard more and more about this company she was building that sounded so great. And so just at a personal level, I was curious what the experience would be like. I walked into our nearest Walgreens in Palo Alto. They had an area dedicated to the Theranos product. And I said, hey, I'd like a blood test. Can you tell me what my cholesterol level is? I'm in general a believer in consumer healthcare. The consumer should have control to have their own information. And they said, yes, they could do it. And I said, great, I'm ready to give a drop of blood. And they said, oh, that test doesn't work on a drop of blood. And I said, okay, you've got more than 100 tests here. Which ones do work on a drop of blood? And they got a little uncomfortable and they said, well, maybe only a couple. And I listened to it and it didn't sound like they had their story very clear. And it also sounded like maybe they were marketing more than they had available at the time. So I didn't know everything going on under the covers. It was only a year later that I learned about some of the serious issues going on. But even at the time, it didn't seem quite right.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're speaking with Dan Riskin, who was with us back in April, and he's back with us today to talk about the current Theranos trial and also to talk about medical startups and those sorts of things. Dan, I'm curious, when the Wall Street Journal came out with the scathing two stories, I think it was back in 2015, she came on a couple of days later and said, you know, we have these databases that will be able to exonerate us. We have all the data. Everything's right here. And then the database, of course, mysteriously disappears. And being a person in technology, I certainly am aware of how databases have backups and about how the strategic data of a company is so important that you make sure that you have backups and you make sure you have this information. Is this something you think that is going to be used by the prosecutors to tell their story?
They may well, but it's just hard to believe the story, meaning investigative journalism at the top franchises is so good these days. And even when that first article came out, most of us that I knew in the Valley were looking at it saying, that's probably true. It was believable, sadly believable. And you looked at it and said, well, that's not the kind of thing people would make up. The Wall Street Journal isn't going to make this up. So at that point, of course, she has the right to mount her defense, and she should. But that level of suspicion, quite frankly, even after the first article, is a killer for a startup.
Yeah, it certainly is. So the prosecutors opened up the case yesterday, sort of describing her as a villainous person who was a con artist. And, of course, the defense came in and said that she was a failed business person and that other companies have failed in the Valley and around the world. So this is going to go on for, they say, several months. Do you think it's going to go that long?
I think there's a lot to tell. I wouldn't be surprised if it goes on that long. It's the job of lawyers to show the extreme, to give a good defense and a good prosecution. The truth is almost certainly somewhere in between, and it's going to take time to show the truth because of all the details that go on in a company that of that size, with that kind of valuation, with that many transactions.
Yeah. I'm wondering, it's so interesting how that very savvy investors invested heavily in this company, Theranos. Very well-reputed people who are everyday household names like Henry Kissinger were on her board. How did that happen? I'm just really confused by how many people were sort of tricked by this. And isn't there some sort of standard within healthcare startups that, you know, you get FDA approval and you get patent approval and all this sort of thing to prevent from happening what happened?
When I started building products a couple of decades ago and started in Silicon Valley in 2004, those were relatively early days of venture, meaning venture had been a cottage industry. It had been there for a few decades, but it was small. And during that period, more and more people came into the field. There are just such strong incentives for people to be investors where they get to invest a lot of money and capture substantial parts of the gains. As we see more and more people come into the field of venture, the field gets more sophisticated. You asked whether there were standards. They're being developed, but still it feels in many ways like a cottage industry. Someone comes in with a slide deck. There's an hour-long meeting. The person shows the slide. They either excite the investors or not. If they excite the investors, it turns into a series of meetings. And after a series of meetings and a bit of diligence, an investment happens or it doesn't. Investors will rarely dig into the details of a patent or dig into a proof of a technology. It's not something that most investors are equipped to do. And in this case, those household names that invested, not all of them were what we would consider sophisticated investors in healthcare. Not all of them had evaluated thousands of firms and made tens or more investments in healthcare. Many of them were relatively new to healthcare technology, even though they were household names.
And so really the idea is that they're hearing something, they think it sounds promising, you might as well get in early. I'd love for you to tell us a little bit about your healthcare technology startup. Much like Elizabeth Holmes, you as a student designed a painless wound closure device. And then it went through patent approval, FDA approval, and then it was, you turned it into or co-founded a medical technology company commercializing the product. Can you take us through that? And then, and maybe in addition to that, talk about how an investor or a consumer could trust this sort of process.
Sure. Those were the early 2000s, and it was a wild time to be in Silicon Valley. It was so exciting for me as a young doctor to have the opportunity to invent. In this situation, I was a fellow in medical technology at Stanford, and I had so many resources available, from money to prototyping technologies to people who were so talented. And it was an overwhelming experience, meaning I didn't really know the way the game was played. I didn't know how to go about raising capital. I didn't know how to get a product used. But I had a lot of excitement. I knew clinical problems because I had been a doctor for a few years. And I had a mind that worked with technology. With that said, it was all the usual problems. In this case, I had never been a CEO before, and I brought in someone to be CEO. They had to go raise capital. They had to convince investors to invest. And it was difficult, particularly in those days after a recession, as we've had several over the past decades. It's just a difficult experience, and you're always trying to strike a balance between being optimistic about what can be achieved. They call that the hockey stick curve, where you show that the company is going to become hugely valuable in just a short time, versus being realistic and saying, listen, this is hard, it's going to take a long time, we have a lot of things to prove, the product needs to be refined, and maybe it's not going to have a massive return for you in a few years. There's a balance to be struck there, and it's a very difficult balance to find.
It certainly is, because the hockey stick, if you don't have it, if it's not moving up and to the right on an XY axis on not only a quarterly basis, but possibly a monthly basis, and I remember with the technology startup companies that I was involved in, sometimes they would sit us down, and I was running sales, and they would say, what are you going to book and ship this week? And if the hockey stick wasn't there, the VCs would typically take off. So there's a lot of pressure. It's difficult.
Well, and that's their model. I've been an entrepreneur and CEO. I've also been an investor. And on the investor side of the table, you're being trusted with other people's money, sometimes someone's pension fund or critical money for a group, and you're being trusted to invest it wisely. You might invest in 10 companies knowing that the large majority will fail. And in that situation, knowing that the large majority will fail, every company better have a chance to be big, because you're reliant on one or two of those companies having a massive return. Only in that way can you actually be good to the limited partners investing in you and show a return. If you're not doing that, you're not being a good investor. And so it ends up flowing downstream where the investors require the entrepreneurs to show them a vision where this company can be hugely valuable. Of course, the investors are expected to discount that, to assume that it may not happen. In fact, most of the time it doesn't happen. But if there isn't even a possibility of it happening, it's not a worthwhile investment in that venture model.
Yeah, and I always appreciate it when the VCs would take an active interest in what you were doing. They have decided to put some money in. Now there may be another round after that and possibly a round after that. And they just want to make sure that they're doing some kind of diligence. So besides those early meetings, I remember meeting a couple of VCs. I was running sales. And they asked permission of the CEO if they could contact me regularly and not talk specifically about my pipeline and what the opportunities were. But they were always asking the same questions in some different ways about what are the networking business problems that your product is solving? What are the networking business problems that your pipeline has? Give us some examples of the company. So they were always doing diligence, and I appreciated that because we all wanted this thing to be successful, but we had to be totally, totally honest. And I think we were very conservative. And if anyone's ever seen a red herring in the prospectus that comes out, I mean, everybody talks about their risks very openly. You have to, or you're open to all sorts of lawsuits potentially.
It's a very good sign when an investor is interested enough to dig in after investment, to ask to speak to someone other than the CEO. It's also a very good sign when the CEO is open to that and says, yes, talk with whoever you like in my organization. We are real. I think there are two factors going into this. One, the investor wants to know there's legitimacy. It's important for their brand that this company be legitimate. It's important for their follow-on investment that the company be legitimate. And two, the investor wants to help. Now, not all investors can help, but all investors want to. They want that investment to be successful, and if they can do something to make the company more successful, they would gladly do it. So those two items play in. That is, in many ways, the best side of the industry. There are dark areas, but that's an area that has always been really appealing to me as I've grown companies.
Mm. Dan, it seems like the solution to this sort of issue that has created the problem with Theranos and this fraud trial that Elizabeth Holmes is going through currently, the trial began yesterday, would be a sort of, you know, like an expert witness, but that's not the right term, because it would be someone like you who's both, you know, a doctor, an investor, an entrepreneur, all these things, to be sort of the go-between, the venture capital money and the product. What kinds of things has this Theranos issue? What do you hear about in Silicon Valley now about how to sidestep this kind of, you know, horrible issue that's all over the news right now?
Well, I think you're absolutely right, Lynn. To protect patients, there needs to be really good diligence, not only before an investment, but after an investment. That effort to ensure legitimacy, to protect the company, the entrepreneur, the investor, the patients. I've been brought in many times by investors who are friends, who have asked me to look at a portfolio company. It will often be a Series A or Series B company with a product or a new product line that is appealing but might be struggling. I remember one example of that. And this is perhaps an outlier example. I was brought in by a tier one investor to see a company that used catheters as medical devices to accomplish something great. I won't give more detail because the story doesn't go well. I went and looked at the firm. I spoke with the CEO. I spoke with the head of engineering and other people. I dug into some of the algorithms that were being used. And I came back to the investor and I said, listen, the team is not doing proper science. In this case, they were using a training data to claim accuracy results that would not be replicable in the real world. And I said, you think you're achieving 80% accuracy, but in fact, it'll be far, far lower. And that would have led to patient harm. That kind of digging in on the part of the investor, I think, is helpful. In the end, the investor didn't do a follow-up investment. The company folded. But it required someone who is an expert coming in and really looking. And at least from what I've read in the news, that potentially didn't happen in Theranos.
I see. And luckily, with Theranos, I believe there was no harm done to patients, which, as you say, is the most important thing. Is that right?
I think there may have been harm done to patients. As I have spoken with people in the Valley, I agree that the majority of the harm discussed is financial harm. This idea that there may have been fraudulent claims that led to large rounds of investment that led to a lot of people losing money. And that's not good in Silicon Valley. And it's illegal and it's potentially criminal. And the trial will determine whether it happened. There's another set of items that are discussed, and they're around whether blood tests were performed and gave bad results to patients. Things like prostate cancer and pregnancy tests. If that was truly done, and that's what's being claimed, if that was truly done, that's incredibly harmful. Someone who believes that they have prostate cancer when they don't, or someone who believes that they are not pregnant when they are, it's easy to imagine how that can destroy lives. And that really is the hardest part for any healthcare entrepreneur to swallow, someone who's been in Silicon Valley a long time. We all understand there's hype in this industry. We all understand the rules of that game. But the idea that someone would step that far to lead to patient harm, I think that it gives us the shivers. It's just unbelievable.
Yeah, it certainly does. And I think one of the other challenges is our human nature. And a couple of things. One is people want to join the herd. And you get General Mattis, Henry Kissinger, Secretary Shultz, Bill Frist, Rupert Murdoch. Hey, man, they probably know what they're doing, so they want to join the herd. And the other thing is, and this is very strong in Silicon Valley, and that is it's just part of human nature. Everybody wants the home run. Everybody wants that. And so that's kind of difficult, and that sort of gets in the way sometimes, doesn't it?
I think it is. I think it's required in the venture model to have a company that can have a home run. And you're right, everyone wants it. The investor wants it. The entrepreneur wants it. Not everything should be a home run. We look at companies that are more social focused, that are more altruistic. Sometimes they shouldn't be a home run. Sometimes they should be a base hit, something that maybe doubles or triples in value, doesn't become 10x. We look at other companies that are good in healthcare that really would make a difference for patients, but maybe they aren't working in a billion-dollar market. Not everything can or should be a home run. With that said, the venture model certainly, in large part, requires that.
Yeah, and they could have a portfolio of 30 companies, and they're, when they do their math at the end of the day, they're only looking for two or three home runs. They know that there'll just be some singles and maybe some pop-ups. That's their mentality. But I'm talking about the personal investor who gets all caught up in the hype and they want to go to the promised land financially. And so that's it's just difficult. And I look forward to seeing this play out. I'm fascinated that they were able to put together a jury. I always, It always surprises me. You know, there's an HBO documentary. There's testimony and comments by Schultz and Frist and Murdoch. And there's all this information which is out there, and somehow they're able to cobble together a 12-person jury. And that always surprises me. How long? Do you know how long it took them to put their jury together?
I don't know how long it took. I think it's interesting. I think the requirement that people be willing to listen and not be influenced by the news and not be influenced by their preconceptions, it's really a beautiful part of American democracy. And yes, it's impressive that a jury could be put together with people who could, I would expect, honestly say that they could do that. I think it would be hard for most of us to serve on a jury like this. We've heard the news. We've read about Theranos. We are incensed that there may have been substantial lies here and that they may have harmed patients. I think it's great that this is being done in the sophisticated way that the U.S. Can run a trial. And I do look forward to hearing the outcome of it.
Well, Dan Riskin, it's been a pleasure having you back on Cool Science Radio. Dan is the founder and CEO of Verantos, and we invited him to speak about the Theranos trial of Elizabeth Holmes. It'll end up being very interesting, as many people compared Elizabeth Holmes to Steve Jobs in both the way they approached business and life, even down to the way she wore the black clothes like Steve Jobs, and yet the two seem at this point to be so very different. So it will be interesting to follow this case, and we certainly appreciate you joining us again on Cool Science Radio.
Oh, it was really my pleasure. Thank you both, and I look forward to talking with you again.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio.
If you enjoyed this episode, please rate us, give us a 5. And leave us a comment.
Take us along on your next adventure to the moon.
If you have any story ideas, please let us know at coolscienceradio@kpcw.org.
Thanks for listening. And hey, tune in next week.